Now let us hear the reading of the Word of God, the 139th Psalm. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou understandest perfectly my thoughts, even from afar. Thou searchest out my path and knowest where I lie down. Indeed, Thou art acquainted with every way of mine. For there is not a word that comes to my tongue. But lo, O Lord, Thou hast already known it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and placed Your hand on me. Such knowledge is too marvelous for me. It is high, indeed I cannot begin to reach it. Whither shall I go from Thy Spirit, or flee from Thy presence? If I ascend into heaven, Thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, Thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall Thy hand lead me, and Thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall overwhelm me, why the light about me shall be night. Even the darkness does not hide from Thee, but the night shines even as the day. For darkness and light are both alike to Thee. Thou didst form my inner being. Thou didst cover me in the womb of my mother. And so I will give thanks to Thee, for I am indeed fearfully and marvelously made. And Thy works are so wonderful, and I know it right well. My frame was not hidden from Thee when I was being made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance when as yet even unformed. And in Thy book, they were all written down. Even the days that are ordained for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are Thy thoughts unto me, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. And when I awake, lo, I am still with Thee. Surely Thou wilt slay the wicked, O God, so depart from me, therefore, you bloody men. For they speak against Thee wickedly, and Thine enemies take Thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate Thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against Thee? Indeed, I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. But search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me. And know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is one of the Psalms that is a great commentary on several important theological themes. As you'll notice in the bulletin, I have listed one or two of them that are rather comprehensive in their scope. The Lord, His omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence. And the first thing I want to say by way of background is that you would expect these kinds of words from the psalmist when we remember that the Hebrew people, their faith was based really in what we call the doctrine of the providence of God. To the Hebrew people, he did not think much like the Greek, that time simply goes around in circles. The same thing happens over and over again if you just wait long enough for it. That was utterly foreign to the Hebrew concept. The Hebrew concept was that God is working His purpose out as year succeeds to year. We may not be able to see it, but He sees the end from the beginning. And while men thwart His purpose from time to time, and they get in His way, and they constitute stumbling blocks for the immediate carrying out of His purpose, God never has to pay off every Saturday night. Indeed, He very seldom does that. But He simply uses our blunders and the obstacles that we place in His way and rides victoriously through them and carries out His changeless purpose. Without trampling on the dignity of your free moral agency or mine, He will not force you to do one thing, one way or another. He'll entreat you, ask you, beg you. But if you, by your willfulness, get in His way, He goes right on His way with His purpose. And so the Jew felt that all sovereignty belongs to God. He is the sovereign Lord of the nations, and His sovereignty expresses itself not only in creation, but in providence, but even to the psalmist, you'll notice even in this 139th Psalm, in redemption. And so this is basic. The Hebrews' concept of God is that God is personal and a God who plans, who has a plan and will carry it out. But the next important thing, it seems to me, for us to remember, and this I have called to the attention of my people from time to time, and I'm most ashamed to mention it again, but there may be some of you who should be aware of this that are not at present so aware of it, that the psalm begins with the word, in the American Standard Version, it begins with Jehovah. In the King James Version, it begins with Lord, with capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, which is simply the Hebrew word Yahweh, which is the old Hebrew word the I Am, which is the Old Testament way of expressing the pre-incarnate Logos, the second person of the Trinity. It is the person with whom Jesus identified Himself over and over again in the New Testament. Jesus would quote an Old Testament passage. The Lord said unto my Lord, Yahweh said unto my Lord, that's me, said Jesus. That's I, said Jesus. Or another passage He would quote, and where Yahweh is in the translation, He almost goes out of His way to say, that's talking about me. When He was invited back there to preach in His own hometown synagogue there in Capernaum, I say hometown while Technically speaking, Nazareth was his hometown. He never called Nazareth his home. Capernaum was the only place he called his home. And in the synagogue there at Nazareth, when they asked him to preach that morning, he found in the scroll the place in Isaiah where it is written, "The Spirit of Yahweh the Lord is upon me, for he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor," and so on. And he read that scroll, rolled it up, gave it to the deacon who placed it back in the chest, and then Jesus sat down to preach. And I've often said I'm glad that they don't do that now. I don't believe I could do much preaching sitting down. But Jesus sat down, and the eyes of everybody were upon him as he began to preach. The first thing that he said in his sermon was to identify the person in that passage in Isaiah that he wrote, that he read. The passage went, "The Spirit of Yahweh, the Lord, is upon me." Jesus says, "I'm that fellow." Or when Isaiah, the same Isaiah in the 6th chapter, had a vision in the temple, he said, "I saw the Lord." Who was he? High and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Who was this Lord that Isaiah saw in 735 B.C.? Who was he? Well, even if John 12 didn't tell me so, I would know when you read the text. He saw Yahweh, the Lord, the pre-incarnate Logos. He saw Jesus in his person before he became a fleshly person born of the Virgin Mary. But John 12 tells us, of course, that Isaiah saw the Lord. And so what I am trying to say is we need to remember that these biblical doctrines that the psalmist expatiates on in 139 are doctrines of which the Lord Jesus in his pre-incarnate existence is the author of. And the first thing that I would call to your attention is the fact that he is the creator. And of course we have this in so many places, I'm almost ashamed to notice it again. But notice that strange passage beginning in the 13th verse. And let me read those words. They're rather delicate, I admit, but we'll understand what this psalmist is saying. "Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst cover me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. My soul, my frame was not hidden from thee when I was made in secret, curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see mine substance before they began to take form." The Hebrew text says, even when I was in embryonic form being fashioned and growing in the womb, you knew all about me. But he is designating Yahweh the Lord as the creator. And the psalmist, in very delicate language and yet nicely put, I'd say, is saying this wonderful thing about creation. And then, as I've said, the Hebrew people never viewed history as any point in history being an isolated event, completely separated from what went before or what may happen after. Always they tied it up, the connecting link with the past and with the future, always was in the person and work of Yahweh, the Lord. This is why history was such a meaningful thing to the Hebrew people. And my friends, we Presbyterians ought to feel that way about it. Just because, humanly speaking, things seem to be out of hand, let us not for a moment feel that God is sleeping, or that he has lost control, and that he is unable to do anything to meet the situation. In the second World War, when Hitler was raising so much sand, and when some of his campaigns against the Jews were so so devastating and abominable. A lot of people, no doubt in Germany, though I did not hear anything from them, but from this side of the Atlantic, a lot of fine Christian people were saying with exasperation and hopelessness, if God be God, where in thunder is he? Why can't he stop that monster? An old pepper hanger from somewhere, why can't he stop him? Well, I noticed God did stop him, but he didn't stop him at exactly the time we think he ought to be stopped, or in exactly the same way. And this is what we need to recognize, which oftentimes the Jew recognized that we don't. That God sees the end from the beginning. He sees both sides of the coin at the same time. Both sides of the pattern of the rug. Very clear to him. And he can bide his time. And let the forces of evil apparently romp all over us. And as the psalmist in another place says, but he that sits in the heavens laughs them to scorn. This was a basic theological position of the Hebrew people. And my friends, I cannot help but think that it made an important contributing fact, that it was a contributing factor to their survival. They trusted in God and his providence and believed that God had a plan and that God realized that history was going somewhere, not just endless repetition. But it's important to note, too, that in this view of history that the Jews had, we call it theism. It takes a slap in the face at what we might call both deism and pantheism. Where deism, and by the way, and humanism too, but deism, that ism that says that God is rather personal and he's powerful, he made the earth, yes, we admit that, and he did some wonderful things. But after he conceived the plan and set this universe off on its course, that's the end as far as God's concerned. He can't do anything more about that. If it gets off its course, God can't help it. If he wants to slow it down, he can't do that. If he wants to speed it up, he can't do that. No matter what happens, God is not able to change the thing. As some scholars say, it's about like a man who winds up the alarm clock and just lets it go. Now, whatever happens whenever it's supposed to alarm, it'll alarm. You just can't stop that unless you change the figure. But this is against deism. God is interested meticulously, particularly with individuals. Yes, indeed. And then it's against pantheism. Pantheism, of course, says that the very highest good that we can imagine is God. Pantheos estin is where we get pantheos, the Greek word. Pantheos estin. Everything, the best of everything taken together, constitutes God. Well, I could think of 8 or 10 very fine men, put them all in the same boat, but I tell you right now, you have the 0 plus 0 plus 0 still equals 0. No, pantheism is not the God of the Bible. But perhaps the most dangerous threat to the theistic view of God, that God is providentially watching over us, caring for us if we'll let him, is humanism, where so many people try to live their lives apart from God's controlling and guiding influence and power. I'd like to live my life by myself. Let me call the strikes. Let me make the decisions. Let me choose the direction. And of course, invariably, when sinful people do all the choosing, they're going to choose wrong. You can bank on that. And many of us, as I've had occasion to say many times before, perhaps in personal experiences, can look back, because hindsight's usually better than foresight, we can look back and see that in our own personal lives, that there has been a guiding hand. Or as Shakespeare said, there is a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them as we will. Don't care what you say about it, there is something back of this thing. If you're going to attribute everything that happens in your life to a mere happenstance, I won't tell you what I think about your intellect. But most of us can think of instances, many of them, that when taken together, you see that there was a pattern behind it. And if the only explanation you can make is that God had something to do with it. I told you about my own personal plans for my life. I certainly thought I had plans. I wanted to. My parents didn't force me to make plans to be anything, especially, but they urged me to be something. And I, because I liked the idea of medicine, just insisted that I was going to be a physician. That's all. Nothing could stop me. And I planned to that end. And when I matriculated at school at college, it was the pre-medical course. I had to take those things that I didn't especially like. There was chemistry, and there was physics, and there was biology, and two or three other things none of which I especially enjoyed. Physics especially was for for something else. But I couldn't pass that stuff. I tried it. I diligently tried it. I thought, well, now, Lord, if you want me to be a doctor, now you better help me with this physics business. Well, even God can't help a man that doesn't have the brains to use. And I took a reexamination in that thing, because the president of the college was that sympathetic with this poor country boy. He knew that the bottom had dropped out for me. I knew that I made 29 in physics, and that wasn't passing. So I asked him to let me take that thing again, and the professor condescendingly said, all right, yes. And I spent all Saturday, wrestled with one of those long sheets of foolscap paper, the long questions. I didn't even know the meaning of the question, much less the hint of the answer. And I made 19. So the only way I could do was to figure that God was sending me a telegram. Boyd, you don't want to be a doctor. Not that you don't want to be, but you can't be. And that's what happened. My mother and my wife both, bless them, they helped me in my dilemma and guided me along and suggested other areas. But what I'm trying to say is that I think God was in that. I didn't have sense enough to do all that by myself. But I think that when God knew that I couldn't do physics, He had another place for me. Maybe some of you are thinking, well, you still missed your call, but I can't. Too late for me to make a change now, I tell you that. Tired of too late. But I believe that basic to a man's real biblical theology is to believe that God is in control, not just generally, hoping that you can work things out for your good, but that He is in control, concerned with you and your choices and your decisions. And that, of course, it requires a response on your part, to be willing to be led. And if you're going to be like a lot of Presbyterians, hard-headed, then it takes even God a little bit longer to deal with you. He has to use a few hickory switches and other things. But God is working. That's the point. And this is the point of the psalmist. Now to show that he is so sold on the personality of God and God's holiness, he cannot stand the possibility of anybody poking fun at God. The atheist, the humanist, the pantheist. He cannot stand it. And so some of his Old Testament lower view of Christian concept comes out. He says, these people that make fun of God, don't I hate them? Oh, I hate them like everything. And I'm going to try to kill them. It's that kind of thing that the psalmist is, of course, not expressing his Christian view of Christian living. He's expressing his view of the holiness of God and how much he loves the holiness of God. He's not wanting us to emulate now his business of hating people and wanting to kill them. It's just illustrating his love of God because of his holiness and of his providential guidance through life. And just once more now, in the end, you'll notice, he says, he makes a prayer with about five little elements in it. Search me, know me, test me, see me, lead me. I think that's a pretty good prayer. Search me, O God. Are we willing for God to search us from time to time? Search me, O God. We all do well to be willing to stand under the infrared light of God's all-searching power to say, God, point out my weaknesses, and for thy mercy's sake, strengthen me, but search me. Not only search me, but know me. And the word know means to know me intimately, to be my friend and my leader and my guide. And then he says, test me. From time to time, give me the chance to show my love and my faith. And then, lead me. Lead me in the way everlasting. I want to commend to you the gist of the 139th Psalm, a great exposition of God's personality, of his love for us individually, of his willingness to guide us if we let him, to test us and try us and lead us.